Do you owe $10,000 or more on at least two federal student loans? Then you may qualify for new programs offered by the Department of Education. These programs can reduce your interest, lower your payments, and possibly qualify you for loan forgiveness. If you have $10,000 or more and at least two federal student loans and currently not in school, you may qualify for one of these programs. Call now to check your eligibility. Student loan advisors are standing by to help you determine if you qualify for these new programs. They can help you reduce your interest, lower your payment, and even forgive a portion of your student loan debt. Take control of your financial future. Make this free 5-minute free call now to Nationwide Student Loans and learn how you can reduce your student loan debt.
800-439-1588. 800-439-1588. 800-439-1588. 800-439-1588.
From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports.
Laura Engelstein is the Henry S. McNeil Professor Emerita of Russian History at Yale, where she served as chair of the history department. Her new book, Russia in Flames, War, Revolution, Civil War, 1914 to 1921. She joins us from Chicago, my hometown. How are you, Laura?
I'm very well. Thank you very much, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I got to tell you, you brought this down to such a personal level. Many people idealize the revolution. I want to start off. It's the 100th anniversary, and yet it seemed to have been largely ignored in Russia. What do you take from that?
Well, the regime of Putin has a very ambivalent attitude toward revolution because, obviously, revolution challenges the authority of the state. So on the one hand, that's not something positive for him, and all the velvet and orange revolutions recently are not something that he likes to contemplate. Also, he thinks of Lenin's contribution to Russian history as having ended in the destruction of the magnificent Russian empire, the imperial state.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Soviet Union created national sub-entities. There was the Soviet Republic of Ukraine and so on. So when the Soviet Union began to weaken and fall apart, Russia was reduced. So Putin is a big state man, and he doesn't like these aspects of the revolution. So it's difficult for him to celebrate it in the present political context.
Interesting. I want to ask now why you focused on 7 years and give it, you know, this is personal to me as we've talked about my family was thrown out of there. It's personal to you. Give us in a short answer why you picked this 7-year period and how its story is personal to you.
Okay. Well, the 7-year period starts with the beginning of the First World War, and it was the First World War that really was the spark, the destabilizing factor that put pressure on the autocracy, the old regime, and caused it to crumble. So it makes sense to start with 1914, even though there was a revolution in 1905 as well. That was part of the undermining of Tsarist authority. And then 1921 is the end of the Civil War. So you have three big, enormous moments, the war, the revolution itself, the political overturn, two political overturns, February and October, and then the big fight to see who was going to win in the end. So those are the 7 years. My personal involvement, my grandfather was in the Russian Imperial Army during the First World War. I think he served as a clerk. My grandparents were semi-educated, literate, but not well-educated Jews from Bessarabia, which is now Moldavia, which is where my mother was born. So they were there in 1920 in the middle of the Russian Civil War. They only got to the United States in 1930. So my childhood was spent hearing not Russian, but Yiddish, but the sense of the old world and of the crisis of this period. So, yeah, I have a personal involvement in that sense.
certainly have made a big success out of your life. It's impressive. Yeah, the conceptual underpinning, Marxism, dictatorship of the proletariat, all of that seems, and you portray it well, is kind of a hypocrisy and con job for where the state of the they were economically. And this seems to happen consistently, whether you go to Cuba with Castro. There's a fundamental betrayal of the promise in these revolutions.
Yes, but I wouldn't call it hypocrisy. These people deeply, sincerely believed that they understood the world mm-hmm. and that they were going to create something better. That I don't want to say that they were hypocrites. Maybe there were some hypocrites among them. But the main leaders, they were true believers. I don't think of this as a religious kind of belief. It was very rational. It was very theoretical. How they actually ended up behaving has been criticized by other people who also believed in socialism as contrary to the basic principles of socialism. And one thing I want to point out about 1917, the Lenin group, the Bolsheviks, were not the only socialists. In February, when the old regime fell, there were moderate socialists, yeah. so-called Mensheviks, even socialist revolutionaries, who were violently critical of Lenin. They were not authoritarian. They thought of socialism as a form of democracy. So I think it's unfair to equate the entire story of 1917 with the Bolsheviks. However, of course, the question is, why were they the ones who ended up on top? How is it that they won? And I hope that my book tries to unravel that question, that puzzle. Some of it is contingent, but I think basically the Bolsheviks were an authoritarian version of socialism. So they were instrumental in using the appeal of socialism to gather a popular following to help undermine the old system. But they truly believed in the goal that they were heading for, that it was going to be better. It's another long story how it got so convoluted and negative. But people from other socialists from the very beginning did not like the Bolshevik version. They were highly critical. They opposed it violently.
The other the big interesting thing, and we'll get into the details later, is how much chaos, bloodshed, and brutality there was during this period that I don't think is so greatly understood. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So usually the emphasis is on the war, the civil war, armies, Cossacks, and so on. But what is forgotten is that the deterioration of social life, of the economy, began even before February 1917. And I'd like to point out that the old regime was largely responsible for its own collapse. The policies that the czarist autocracy pursued during First World War helped undermine the fabric of society. They deported whole populations from the western provinces. They engaged in xenophobic and anti-Semitic propaganda. There were millions, like 3 million or more, refugees streaming into the interior of Russia, which it was incapable of coping with. So there was, and also economically, the old regime was not capable really of conducting the war properly. So it's unfair to say that a small group of left-wing radicals destroyed the old regime. I think the old regime largely undermined itself.
So they deserved to be taken out, let's say. Could they have done anything different, the Romanovs, the Tsar's family, the Tsar himself, to have stayed in power? And obviously we'll talk at the end what resulted. It wasn't exactly better than what was there.
Okay, so one of the problems with an autocracy or a monarchy is mm-hmm. you get the next person in line.
Yes.
So it's unfortunate that Nicholas II was not a very gifted ruler. And he was very stubborn, and he was very reactionary. Of course, Alexander III, who preceded him, was also reactionary. But if I were running the autocracy, I would have said, compromise, enable, provide institutions in which society, which was becoming more and more modern, and modernization is destabilizing. There was a middle class. There were industrialists. There was business. There was industry. Small percentage, of course, 85% of the population were peasants. Give them a real parliament, not a fake parliament, as he had to do it after the revolution of 1905. Enable society to operate. Maybe you'll stay on the throne. Maybe you'll have a more healthy social organism. But we have Nicholas II, who was not good at ruling, who was scared, who was repressive, and that just increased the pressure under the throne. It increased the dissatisfaction of establishment, respectable society. We're not talking about wild anarchists. We're talking about the core of a modernizing, increasingly urbanizing society. I'm exaggerating a little, but still, this was really the heart of things. And these are the people who created the February Revolution. They said, we want responsibility. We want to participate. We want a political life. And he was very rigid. So you can say that the monarchy, in that sense, by accident, if they had a smart guy on the throne, although you can also say, look what happened to Alexander II. He was assassinated. It's a complicated story.
Interesting. Tsar Nicholas, would you say out of touch?
Out of touch, unsuited to his role. And I would say, if I were a psychoanalyst, most people say he wasn't very smart, but also that it was very frightening. So he clung to the most rigid, the most conservative, retrograde aspects of the court and of, you know, high society. Now, you had to have a certain vision, a certain political vision, to understand that just because Alexander II was assassinated, that didn't mean you had to go forward with positive change. So we had a fearful, incompetent ruler. And when the war came, he was pushed aside by his generals and by the people, the most conservative members of civil society who were in the State Duma, which was the parliament. So it wasn't just the unwashed masses who wanted to get rid of him, although they were. The revolution happened because the soldiers rebelled, because the war really, again, economics, the war put pressure on the economy. And the question you asked before about disorder and crime and collapse, this happened after February, and that's not usually sufficiently acknowledged, that there was a real crisis in the basic functions of society and the economy.
Coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH, Greenwich, Connecticut. You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell, and we will continue talking. Lex will dive into the war, provisional government, revolution, and civil war.
Sometimes business owners and entrepreneurs don't follow a traditional schedule. Well, that's where BizTV's Biz Club can work for you on your time. For only $5.95 a month, you can have over 200 hours of our fresh, original content on demand, anywhere, anytime. And with our search feature, you can quickly and easily find the topic or show you're looking for in seconds. Sign up today and see what you've been missing. Free for 7 days. Join the Biz Club. It's BizTV. On your time.
If Ernest Hemingway was alive today, would he say this to you?
Shakespeare, Mark Twain, Edgar Allan Poe, all great writers. And after reading your book, I simply must add you to the list.
Wait, you don't have a book yet. So make a free call to Page Publishing. Their expert staff can help you turn your book idea into a real book, a masterpiece that could someday make the bestseller list in hard copy and digitally all across the world. Page Publishing can help you completely take your idea for a book, write it, and publish it. So if you want to join the ranks of some of the most famous authors in the world, call now for a free information kit. Turn your book idea into publishing gold. Make a free call right now to Page Publishing.
888-785-0618. 888-785-0618. 888-785-0618. That's 888-785-0618.
My name is Jim. I'm a veteran, and I lost both legs in Vietnam. My victory was proving that a disability is not a limitation.
I'm Julius. I'm a veteran. My victory was going from homeless to home.
At DAV, we're on a mission, helping veterans of all generations get the benefits they've earned.
I'm Cece. My victory was finishing my education.
When America's veterans win, we all win. Help us support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
When did your light bulb go off? We're talking about that idea you have for a new product or app. Listen, if you want to make your idea a priority, but you don't know how to get it off the ground, you call Davison, the one company with over 25 years experience and exclusive process that turns ideas into products and apps that are found in retail stores and online. Our team has helped tens of thousands of people, just like you. Call now and ask for our free idea starter guide. We'll show you how to securely get started and protect your idea. Whether you have a patent or not, our process will get your idea ready to get in front of a corporation. Don't let your light bulb of an idea go out. Call Davison now for your free idea starter guide. Davison charges fees for services. 800-213-9256. 800-213-9256. 800-213-9256. Again, that's 800-213-9256.
Tired of paying outrageous prices for Viagra? Well, we have great news for you. Now you can finally get Viagra at huge discounts. Healthy Man allows you to save up to $500 on Viagra. Why pay U.S. pharmacy prices of $15 per pill or more when you can get Viagra for less than $3 a pill? Call today and get 40 Viagra pills for only $99. This can cost as much as $600 at your local pharmacy. You can't afford not to call us. If you want Viagra at the lowest prices, never pay $15 a pill pharmacy prices again. Get Viagra for less than $3 a pill. Call 1-800-521-9579 today and save up to $500 and get 40 pills for just $99. Healthy Man is fast, easy, and affordable. Operators are waiting at 1-800-521-9579 to take your call right now. Call 1-800-521-9579. That's 1-800-521-9579. Again, 1-800-521-9579.
Biz Talk Radio.
Laura Engelstein is the Henry S. McNeil Professor Emerita of Russian History at Yale, where she served as chair of the history department. Her new book, Russia in Flames, War, Revolution, Civil War, 1914 to 1921. You mentioned if you did a little psychoanalysis, talking about personalities a little bit, which I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You talk about this guy being insecure and everything. Tell us the what the brief story is and his reliance on Rasputin.
Okay, well, I have a Russian colleague who wrote a wonderful book about how people fell out of love with Nicholas II. And I have another colleague who wrote a whole book about how the monarchy created this sense of love, of charisma. Because that's what a monarchy needs. Look at England. You need to have someone you can think of as the prince. So Nicholas II was, because he was a czar, quote, loved. But when he became more and more incompetent, when he seemed to fall under the sway of this sinister character, Rasputin, when he seemed to be a cuckolded husband, there were all sorts of rumors, the image of the Tsar began to deteriorate. And people even said things like, we fell out of love with him. So Rasputin is a kind of accidental figure. Empress Alexandra was desperate about her hemophilic son, and these are all the classic elements of the story of Nicholas and Alexandra. And Rasputin, who was not a monk, he was not a sectarian, but he dressed in this soutane sort of, you know, black robe kind of, and had a very sinister, charismatic personality. And the anger and disillusionment and fear of society got fixated on him. It's also true that he had influence to some extent behind the throne. But he became a symbol. And my view of his murder is that it was a kind of substitute. Instead of having a regicide, and there had been palace coups in the past, the assassination targeted not the Tsar himself, but his stand-in, the figure who represented his impotence, his loss of charisma. Hmm. And, of course, and the people who assassinated him were way on the right. They were conservative. These weren't left-wingers, right? They wanted to save the monarchy from itself.
We're talking with Laura Engelstein about the Russian Revolution. In personalities, talk a little bit about Lenin. Certainly a lot of charisma combined with utter ruthlessness.
Absolutely. There is a theory that Lenin became ruthless because circumstances made it necessary to act ruthlessly. Oh, I don't believe that. I think he was always authoritarian. He had a kind of uncharismatic charisma. He wasn't dramatic. He wasn't a flashy speaker like Trotsky. But he had, I still think there's some mystery here. He had enormous authority within the group of people who associated with him. So in 1903, in the 1890s, a Social Democratic Party was created in exile. Now, this was something, there was the Social Democratic Party in Germany, this was the model. It was a mixture of aspiration for socialism, gradualism, modernization would bring about certain kind of change, and then somehow or other also revolution. It wasn't supposed to happen in Russia, it was supposed to happen in a highly industrialized society. Well, Lenin and his comrades out in Europe are trying to think of ways to create a revolution in Russia, but they're out of it. Lenin doesn't come back to Russia till 1917. And he has the other thing about the Bolsheviks is I believe Lenin was always authoritarian. The Bolshevik Party was not always a well-disciplined group. They argued with him. They pushed back. Even in terms of the timing of the October coup, some of his closest collaborators said, no, not now. This is not the right thing to do. We have to wait. We have to have more popular support. So it's still, to me, after all this time, a little bit of a mystery how Lenin managed to get his way at key, crucial strategic moments.
Kerensky, most people may not know, if he had assumed power or more power, would a more democratic, even a democratic capitalism, might have emerged?
Well, the message I want to say about the Russian Revolution, if there's a positive takeaway about 1917, it is that there was a February Revolution, because everyone likes to go from Nicholas II to
right.
Lenin. Russia is doomed. Nicholas II, Lenin, Stalin, Putin. Russia is doomed to authoritarianism. Well, I like to point out that what's passed over in that view is February. February was a democratic upsurge, and I mean everyone in society, from the lowest peasant, they had meetings, they had little, you know, councils and unions and associations in workplaces, in the cities. They were city dumas, city councils. People were absolutely hungry for political life. So this moment, when you say, what did Russian society produce? It produced a democratic upsurge, which was defeated for various reasons, circumstantial, the war, and so on. But I'd like to point out it's the DNA of Russian history is not exclusively autocratic in that sense. So Kerensky, it turns out, was a very skillful politician, and he had to please his constituencies. He had to create a certain image of himself in order to assert his authority. He did have authority in the early months. What he didn't have was power. And the situation was very unstable. Russia was still in the war. And the key $64,000 question, as they used to say in my youth, is why didn't they get out of the war sooner? Okay, when you ask that question, you say, should have, of course. But then you say, Lenin, who wanted to get out of the war, who promised peace in November, he had to coerce, twist arms, argue like mad, get red in the face to get even his own Bolsheviks to agree to the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. It was very hard to get Russia out of the war, even though the war was devastating the country. So this is one of these what-if questions, hard to answer. But I think there was hope for a different kind of outcome at the beginning of 1917.
Fascinating.
And one of the things I try to do in this book, which makes it unfortunately rather fat, is that often the story of the Civil War is told as a Russian story.
Yeah.
And Russian language has two words for Russian, the adjective. Российский, which is a political word, which is that was the Russian Empire, Российская империя. And then Русский. Русский is the culture, the language, which refers to that part of the Russian Empire. Well, the Russian Empire was great. It covered one-sixth of the Earth's land surface because it incorporated a lot of non-Russian parts, the whole Western periphery, the Baltic states, Poland conquered in the late 18th century, incorporated Kiev. There's an argument from between the Ukrainians and the Russians whether it was incorporated or whether it was constitutive. Anyway, the Kievan, there was no Kiev in the old, there was no Ukraine, excuse me, in the Russian Empire. It was a series of provinces in the Western side. Conquest of the Crimea, conquest of the Caucasus, conquest of Central Asia was still going on in the 19th century. When the monarchy fractures, the parts, the periphery starts to fall away. And what I want to show in the book is that in each of these areas, there is an indigenous urge, movement for self-rule, for autonomy, for self-assertion. So these different stories start to break away, but they're all connected to the central story. And part of the emergence of the Baltic states and of Poland as independent states in this period also has to do with the war, because the central powers are invading. They're already on former imperial territory by 1915. And with the backing of the foreign powers, these segments, these geographic segments of the old empire, make a bid for independence. Even Ukraine, as we know, with German backing at first and then in its own right, wanted to pull away and become an independent state.
Russia in flames, war, revolution, civil war, 1914 to 1920.
All today on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.
National Funding Group has just released $100 million in easy access small business funding to businesses that gross at least $100,000 a year. You can have fast access up to $500,000 in new business capital in as little as 48 hours. Think about the ways you could grow your business if you had up to a $500,000 cash infusion. Call a NFG funding expert now. The process is easy. It only takes about 5 minutes. Then our management-owned lending team looks at your application for a fast approval. You can get 100% funded in about 2 days. If you need up to $500,000 in working capital to run your business and you gross at least $100,000 a year, call NFG and apply today. 800-296-1564. 800-296-1564. 800-296-1564. That's 800-296-1564.
How old are you? 25, 35, 50, or older? If you have pain, we can help. Do your knees hurt?
Ow!
Let me ask you again. Are your knees killing you?
Oh, yeah. Are they ever?
What about your back? When you bend over, does it feel like this? How about when you get out of bed in the morning? If you're like me, your knees and back feel like this.
Oh, that hurts.
I found a company called the Pain Relief Hotline. They specialize in ways to treat your knee, back, and neck pain without surgery or taking medications. The good news is if you have insurance, you may have little or no cost or out-of-pocket expense. I've used them. It works. Call the Pain Relief Hotline now for free information. 800-303-4607. 800-303-4607. Call now. 800-303-4607. That's 800-303-4607.
Attention business owners and independent contractors. This is a money-saving message from Tax Mediation Services. If your business owes $20,000 or more in taxes, we can help you today, right now. Listen, dealing with the IRS is no picnic. It's an intimidating and extremely stressful process, and you don't want to go it alone. Our attorneys know every law, every tax break, and every possible opportunity to help you resolve and reduce your tax debt. And if you owe more than $20,000, you may be at the top of their hit list. So don't take your tax debt lightly, because it will not go away on its own. The IRS can seize your bank accounts, your home, and even shut down your business. Call our tax experts today at 1-800-711-6812 and let us deal with the IRS while you focus on your business. That's 1-800-711-6812. Again, that's 800-711-6812.
Are you ready to leave your corporate job behind and be your own boss? Have you ever dreamed of owning a business? Do you have $50,000 or more sitting around in a 401k? If you answered yes, it's time to invest in yourself by buying or starting a business or franchise. IRS code allows you to use money in a 401k to invest in a business with absolutely no penalties or taxes. At Guidant Financial, we've helped more than 11,000 entrepreneurs invest $3 billion in retirement assets into the small businesses and franchises of their dreams. So if you've got $50,000 or more in a 401k and you're looking for a way to start a business, call Guidant Financial now for free information and to learn more. Operators are standing by for your call. 800-570-6630. 800-570-6630. 800-570-6630. That's 800-570-6630. Do you have an old car sitting in your driveway? How would you like to learn a hassle-free way to get rid of it
help kids in need, and get a great tax donation in the process. It's real easy. One simple free call to our car donation hotline is all it takes. Call the Neshama Foundation at 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723. We'll come pick your car up for free and give you a tax donation for the full value of the car, running or not. The value of your unwanted car will go to help kids in need. It's fast and easy. Just call us and your car will be gone and on its way to helping children in 48 hours. And you get a nice tax deduction. Call the Neshama Foundation now to get rid of your car, help kids, and get a tax write-off. Call 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723, 800-721-6723. That's 800-721-6723.
Biz Talk Radio.
Talking with Laura Engelstein about the Russian Revolution, Lenin was almost a peace candidate, right? And I want to understand a little bit more about they sort of played around with Germany and the Allies and then the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Kind of put that, wrap that up for us.
Okay, so the promise of the Bolsheviks in November, new calendar, October, old calendar, was peace. So the problem with the moderate socialists and the politicians of the February months was that they believed in continuing the war. So even the Mensheviks thought that the war should be continued. They were known as defensists. So we defend the country and then we make the revolution. Lenin said, no, peace now. So this was a very attractive promise, although he didn't come to power by having a vote on this question. He came to power by dispersing the Congress of Soviets, by arresting the ministers of the provisional government, and then on the table was the problem of creating this peace. So they started to negotiate with the Central Powers. Of course, Russia as a state had an alliance with France and Britain, and Lenin would have been just as happy, and in fact the Bolsheviks in general kept negotiating on all sides to see who would ally with them, who would support them, who would accept them. So they said to the Allied powers, you know, we will conclude a general peace if you come in with us on it. We don't want a separate peace necessarily. Of course, there was no way that the Allies were going to accept this. So Lenin and the Bolsheviks were, in a sense, obliged to come to terms with the Central Powers. Lenin understood they had to get out of the war in order to save the revolution.
Well put, yes. Let's put some architecture over this, the impact of the violence. We're talking rape, torture, murder. I think if I'm right, 10% of the 170 million population disappeared. Just how brutal and impactful this was.
Yes, well, there were different kinds of mass losses, so to speak.
Yes.
I already mentioned the famine among the peasantry, and the famine was, again, a politically generated famine to some extent because it was a product of this ruthless requisitioning. So that's one thing, that this is one enormous component of the losses. Then there is the sort of pervasive brutality, extreme violence of the various contending parties to the Civil War. And here you have, for example, the so-called whites, who were the anti-Bolshevik, were led by the former officers of the Imperial Army, who consolidate mostly in Siberia and in the south, in the Don Basin and so on. They also have the problem of fielding armies and feeding them. They also alienate the local population, but they don't really have well-constructed armies. No one does. They rely on these kind of chieftains, these local charismatic leaders who have their own followers, their armed bands. And, of course, the country is absolutely crawling with men who have defected or deserted or once been in the army with guns in their hands and so on. So they learn violence in the war. And there's a lot of extreme violence already in the First World War before 1917. And the leaders, the Kolchak, the Vrangel, the Denikin, Lenin, Trotsky, Antonov Avdiyenko, all these people trying to run armies, they can't control these guys, but they need them. So you have a kind of free-for-all in terms of violence. This is not a proper war, a civil war. No civil war really is.
The moving to the provisional government, that February timeframe, which you kind of already talked about, is it as simple as brutality won, democracy lost?
Well, some people like to say that the February regime wasn't really democratic because it was run by the business class, by the privileged classes, by the upper classes in general. But I like to think, and I think there's evidence for this, that the urge for democracy went up and down the social scale, that there were institutions of self-representation created from the very bottom of the social hierarchy at all levels. They were spontaneous militias, they were spontaneous organizations, and so on. But why didn't this sort of amorphous, complicated situation prevail? Well, one of the problems was that the situation was deteriorating brutally, and the door was open to a coup in that sense, because the candidates on the scene so far had not been able to gain control of the situation, and the ordinary people were suffering. There was an enormous food shortage. It was a food shortage which started the February Revolution. It wasn't just the generals and the upper-class people who were fed up. And the problem of provisioning, of supporting the army, got more and more acute over the course of 1917. So the Bolsheviks come into a situation which is really falling apart, which is a crisis situation, especially in the capital in Petrograd, where crime was rising, the social services, basic functions of the city were falling apart, people were really desperate. And it was that kind of an opening which gave the Bolsheviks their chance to move in. Lenin was very astute about the necessity of gaining control of whatever institutions existed, of establishing power. And my argument is, the usual phrase is, Bolsheviks came to power, as if power was just there, and then you pick it up and you're powerful. The whole idea of power had deteriorated. No government was able to assert itself by the end of 1917. And Lenin's challenge, the Bolsheviks' challenge, was to create authority, to create power. And in the course of the Civil War, which was incredibly chaotic at an enormous human cost, they actually put together the institutions that would then create a new state and a new regime, primarily the Red Army. This was quite an amazing feat of institutional engineering, if you want to put it that way.
Interesting. The defining moment in October, is it a coup? What actually made the exact moment happen?
Okay, so the official Soviet line for all the years of the Soviet Union was this was the great proletarian revolution, where the organized working class, with the conscious desire to have the Bolsheviks in particular in command, created a popular revolution in October, which threw out the so-called bourgeoisie. Well, there was very little popular participation in the actual events of October 25, 6, 7. This was, I want to call it a coup, not because I associate myself with extremely right-wing historians who denounce everything about the revolution starting in October as reactionary. That's wrong what I just said. Conservatives would celebrate reactionary as denouncing everything as oppressive and authoritarian. I agree that Bolsheviks were authoritarian, but I see and I agree that this was a coup. But I don't agree that there was no popular enthusiasm for this move. They did it in an undemocratic way, but the popular masses were really desperate at this point. So there really was an appeal in the Bolshevik slogan of peace, bread, and land. Furthermore, the Bolsheviks didn't do it alone. They allied with the SR Party, the Socialist Revolutionaries. And the SRs had a big following among the peasantry. They stood for the peasant revolution. So the Bolsheviks, who were not supposed to be representing the peasants, they were Marxists, they were supposed to represent the proletariat, they collaborated, they partnered, so to speak, with the more radical elements in the Socialist Revolutionary Party. And they really did have a popular appeal. Their slogans were genuinely popular. But there was no popular revolution in the actual events of October. Furthermore, there were two really important events. One was the arrest of the provisional government, the ministers. The second was preempting the Congress of Soviets. They didn't want democratic endorsement. They wanted to put their stamp on this moment. And the third really important moment, not often recognized, was the dispersal of the Constituent Assembly in January 1918. What was that? For months, everyone was saying, the government will be determined by a constituent assembly. It was a provisional government which created universal suffrage, including women, in July 1917. Millions of people went to the polls, including peasants. And this is what I mean by a democratic upsurge. They voted for delegates to the constituent assembly. The Bolsheviks let it convene, and then they close it down with a show of military force. So the hallmark of Lenin was use force, establish your authority by acting as if you have authority. And from then on, it was war.
You know, it sounded almost like Iraq, what you just described. Remember, they gave the vote to Iraq. Everybody turned out and initially, and it didn't mean anything.
It's important to recognize that people turn out, even under the most chaotic of situations. And that's what I find astounding about this Russian story. I don't like to denigrate Russia as this hopeless place. I want to say it had a pretty devastating outcome, the revolution. But there was this moment in 1917 which needs to be recognized. I don't think it's the kind of moment that Putin wants to recognize, because that's not the kind of ruler he is. But I think it's something that people in the West ought to acknowledge, ought to know about.
Laura Engelstein is the Henry S. McNeil Professor Emerita of Russian History at Yale, where she served as chair of the history department. Her new book, Russia in Flames, War, Revolution, Civil War, 1914 to 1921. Our final segment coming up, Russia Then and Now.
If you're 85 or younger, would you like peace of mind and comfort for your family? We're Final Expense Direct with an urgent message for you. The average funeral today costs over $8,000, but the most you'll get from government benefits is $255. How will your family pay the difference? We can help. Our senior plans start as low as just a dollar a day and pay up to $30,000 for a funeral and other final expenses. Peace of mind is easy. There's no medical exam. You'll have lifetime coverage, and your plan can't be canceled as long as you pay your premiums. Call now for free information about our senior plans. Answer a few simple questions and receive approval right on the phone. Plus, call right now and we'll give you a discount prescription card for free. Call 800-595-6619. That's 800-595-6619. Again, 800-595-6619.
Do you need a car? Been shopping only to be turned down because of bad credit, low credit, no credit, bankruptcy, or divorce? Guess what? Today's your lucky day, because now you can buy a car, truck, or SUV, just about any vehicle. It's true. Bad credit? Doesn't matter. No credit? Doesn't matter. Bankruptcy or divorce? It just doesn't matter. As a matter of fact, your job is your ticket to your new vehicle. We're Auto Credit Express, and we've helped thousands of people just like you. Antonio H. told us, great company, got me connected, and the day I went in, I drove off in the car I wanted. 100% worth your time. Need a car? Get started now and drive off as early as today. Just go to 11ignoremyscore.com right now. That's www.11ignoremyscore.com. Auto financing the easy way. 11ignoremyscore.com. Get started today. Auto financing the easy way.
Here's George Foreman with InventHelp.
Hi, I'm George Foreman. Do you have an idea for a new product or invention? People ask me all the time, George, how do I get my idea in front of companies? How do I get a patent? What do I do next? Do you have the same questions? I'll tell you like I'll tell them all. Call my friends at InventHelp.
Call InventHelp today for free information. InventHelp has been helping inventors for more than 30 years and has sales offices nationwide. InventHelp can submit your invention to companies who are interested in receiving new ideas. If you have an idea and want to try to patent it and submit it to companies, you should call InventHelp today for free information.
Listen, I can't guarantee a company will be interested in your idea, but I believe every inventor deserves the opportunity to step into the ring and take their best shot. Put InventHelp in your corner.
To get your free inventor's information, call 1-800-351-1453. That's 1-800-351-1453. Again, 1-800-351-1453.
If you're over the age
age of 50 and considering buying an annuity in the next 60 days, I have some important news for you. Don't buy an annuity until you understand the pros and cons of annuities. A free book to help you maximize your retirement income from television host and three-time author Josh Melberg has been released. This book reveals little-known truths about annuity strategies in simple-to-understand terms. Grab a pen right now, because we are about to offer you this free book that unlocks the five little-known secrets we believe baby boomers and seniors should know before buying an annuity. Call 800-935-0752 now and you'll receive a free copy of Josh Melberg's book, Next Gen Annuity Strategies Revealed. As a bonus, we'll also send you a copy of The Number One Mistakes Retirees Are Making with Their Investments Today and a free DVD on how you can get up to 33% more income in retirement. Call 800-935-0752. That's 800-935-0752. Employees of J.D. Melberg Financial have the appropriate licenses for the products they offer.
Greece is cheap.
But the airfare costs a fortune.
Paris?
Not much closer, and again, airfare...
What about Puerto Vallarta?
Let's face it, flying anywhere is just too expensive.
Wait, what's this? Low-cost airlines.
With one call to low-cost airlines, you'll drastically slash your travel costs. We're talking insanely low airline prices to any of your favorite destinations. Where would you like to go? London, Rome, Costa Rica, Australia?
Wow, that's cheap.
So why wait? Call now to learn how crazy cheap it is to fly anywhere in the U.S. or international. Our prices are so low, we can't publish them. The only way to get them is to call to instantly hear the most amazing best deals on airlines. Travel. It's that easy. So call now and start packing.
800-217-5107. 800-217-5107. 800-217-5107. That's 800-217-5107.
Biz Talk Radio.
And we're back. Laura Engelstein's done a seminal work on the Russian Revolution right into the streets themselves. So, Laura, as we close the clock on that, the revolution turned on itself, right?
In what sense do you mean?
Almost crumbled of its own brutality, if you will.
If you're talking about what happened at the end of the Civil War, 1921, of course, there's a very interesting shift. This is beyond the scope of the book, but the whole book sets up for this moment, mm-hmm. which is and since you're an economic show, you'd be interested to know, your hearers, listeners, that the period of the Civil War was a period of what later came to be called war communism, like instant communism, the nationalization of factories, the attempt at some point to get rid of currency, the attempt to control everything from the center. Well, all this effort, which was really a response to the emergency of having to fight a multi-front war with various different opponents, both nationalist and internal opponents, left-wing opponents, right-wing opponents, this was sort of a product of necessity. But the revolt of the Kronstadt sailors, the famine in the countryside, really forced the Bolsheviks' hand. And in 1921, they shifted to what was called the new economic policy. And they brought back certain aspects of the market economy, because clearly this attempt to completely control, completely nationalize, very clearly led to disaster. And a disaster in simple economic terms and in social terms, in terms of the support, the reaction of the population. So 1921 is a turning point economically and politically. It doesn't last. It's very soon undermined. Lenin dies in 1924. By this time, Stalin really has positioned himself within the bureaucracy in a position of power. And by 1927-8, he's in control. And that's when the really ruthless elements of what becomes Stalinism, forced collectivization, forced industrialization, come into play. And the human cost is even greater.
That's your next book.
No, thank you.
where you finish off in 21, Russia worse off than they would have been under the Tsar, or where?
That's very hard to say, because the Tsar's regime was really incapable of meeting the challenge of modern warfare. So in order to imagine that the Tsarist regime had survived into 1921, you would have to have imagined a regime that was capable of conducting the war up to that point. and emerging victorious along with the other allies. And then in your imagination, you could suppose that the regime would have moved forward, that maybe they would have had to find another ruler, or maybe even Nicholas would have gotten some sense knocked into his head, hard to imagine, in which... But then you have to also remember that the Russian Empire was not the only empire that fell apart as a result of World War One. The Ottoman Empire collapses. Right. The Habsburg Empire collapses. The German Reich ceases to be a monarchy and becomes a parliamentary regime. So this is more than just a Russian story. One of the challenges of writing the story is it's complex internally, and it links up to the whole political situation throughout Europe, a global situation. So it's really hard to imagine that that empire, that archaically structured empire, could have survived the First World War. So then you're thrown back to what my colleagues were arguing in 2014. Why did we have to have World War One to begin with?
Now, a brief one here. Is there any comparison between Kerensky failing using a lack of violence or power and Perestroika failing under Gorbachev?
Under Perestroika, yes, it's interesting, the Gorbachev phenomenon, in which the whole ideology which had undergirded the Soviet Union had began to lose its power to convince people. People stopped believing in it. There was also an economic crisis. There was also the general shift in society after the death of Stalin, after Khrushchev, in which the old rigor, the old conditions no longer pertained. It's a complicated story why the Soviet Union actually collapsed. It's the loss of a regime that had a lot of authority. Kerensky was in a position of having to establish authority.
Good point.
So he wasn't losing authority that was there. He was in the position of having to make it. And that he was unable to do for lots of complicated reasons. Lenin did it in a brutal fashion. But he established a kind of authority that Kerensky was not aiming for.
Now, we get down towards the end and towards the more recent period. Russia's GDP is now the size of Italy, having the country having broken apart. And where do you see Putin on reconstruction of the empire? And, you know, the Ukrainian sort of independence and war back in the time of your book is still going on today.
Yes. 2018 is going to be the 100th anniversary of the independence of Poland, the independence of Ukraine, although it isn't really the birth of the independence of Ukraine. Ukraine becomes an internal component of the Soviet Union. The Bolsheviks in 1918 considered Ukraine an integral part of Russia. They didn't think of themselves as, they thought of themselves as snuffing out a nationalist movement, but they thought of themselves as having a right to that territory, as being an integral part of the Soviet Union, became the Soviet Union. You could say that Poland was different, Finland was different, the Baltic states were different. They had a political profile at some point. Of course, they retained the Caucasus at this point. They retained Central Asia. They had a fight for all of that. I do argue that ultimately Ukraine was maintained through by conquest as a military victory. Also, the Ukrainians had a lot of trouble in 1918 establishing their own authority with respect to their own population, creating their own sort of convincing government. Of course, there were many reasons why that was difficult to do. So it was a combination of Ukrainian weakness and Bolshevik determination, or I should say, actually sometimes very contingent victories of the Red Army. The Red Army was unable, for example, to win over Poland, and that can be considered an accident. There's a whole story of how that happened, but they failed with Poland. They succeeded with Ukraine. Today, I think Putin is trying to establish the great powerness of Russia, despite its loss of territory and its loss of standing in the world, by asserting itself. And it asserts itself in relation to Ukraine in a military fashion. It's asserting itself with relation to the West by all this cyber terrorism, or whatever you want to call it, cyber subversion. That's probably a better word. He's posturing. He wants to put Russia back in the great power game.
Do you see them collapsing again, inevitably? Just a few seconds answer.
No. I don't see Russia collapsing. I see Russia remaining. I see Russia remaining as a very important nation that has to be taken into account by the rest of the world, even though it is smaller than it used to be.
Thanks to Laura Engelstein, a tremendous effort.
If you're listening now on our flagship station, stay with us as we go into overtime. More on Putin's Russia with Bill Browder. Thanks to our national audience for listening. See you next Sunday on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.
The opinions you hear on Biz Talk Radio are those of the hosts, callers, and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, Biz Talk Radio, its management, or advertisers. The information on Biz Talk Radio does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. Please consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions about Biz Talk Radio, contact us at 817-274-1609 or at biztalkradio.com. Biz Talk Radio,